Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
You guys, I can't believe we haven't had him on the show before. Like, I'm shocked. We're awful. We're awful friends, awful coworkers, and apparently awful baseball fans, because he's got some great takes, great information, and you should be following him. Brandon Gustafson joining us right now on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Brandon, first of all, I haven't seen you since maybe Christmas. Like, it's been a really, of like 2019, like it, I don't remember what you look like. I mean, has your life changed? We haven't seen you in forever, man.
Just been kind of holed up and working and just doing my thing, writing stuff out for the site. But at least lately, I've been able to go to a few Mariner games, so at least that's been fun.
Oh, I lied. I did see you at one of those. Speaking of Mariners games, Brandon. Thank you so much. I'm hoping that you can help us make sense of some of the peaks and valleys that a young team is going to have. It feels like they are all over the place. One minute you have Kelnick having a breakout game. The next minute you're no hit by kind of a middle of the road pitcher, like not a guy that's going to be an ace on any specific team. So, I mean, is this something that's normal for a team in the current phase of rebuilding that the Mariners are, or is this something that they've got to fix?
They need to fix it. There's too much talent in this lineup right now to be going out there and flirting with no-hit bids into the sixth or seventh inning seemingly once or twice a week. That's when you have guys like Jared Kelnick and Mitch Haniger and Kyle Seager and Kyle Lewis on the front four of your lineup. Those are guys that should be getting on base on a semi-regular basis. And really, Haniger's the only guy that's been doing that. I think he's the only guy on that team that's hitting over 240 right now. Everybody else is 220, 230, or in the 100s. I think that part of it is an approach thing. We hear so much about dominate the zone and control the zone, and people seem to think of that as, oh, well, they're going up there trying to work counts and work walks. Well, dominating the zone isn't just that. If there's a pitch that's over the plate that you can do damage with, that's what needs to be done, and they're missing those pitches. Scott Service has talked about it a lot. They're getting some good pitches to hit. They're just not doing anything with them. We're seeing too many weak groundouts, rollovers. Infield pop-ups are basically the equivalent of a strikeout in today's game. They're the easiest thing to field and get as an out for a defense. So there's a lot that this group needs to improve on. They need to turn a corner here. The last 3-4 weeks have just been really, really tough to watch just from an offensive standpoint.
You know, Brandon, you've played the game. You've played baseball in college. And if you're going through something like this from a typical baseball perspective, what's the solution, right? I mean, there's not really any situation where you can go in and say, okay, well, we can sit this guy down and we can bring up a veteran and we can, you know, hide some guys at times or take the pressure off of them. There's really nowhere to hide other than the solution of, you know, figure it out. So, Brandon, my question is, how do they figure it out? What do they do? How do they go through the process of fixing these types of inconsistencies?
Well, and that's what's really hard, Jake, because this is a really young team, and this is a team and an organization just in general that preaches process over results. But that's something that you hear more about with the minor leagues, right? When they're looking at some of these minor league guys, you might look at them and say, oh, the numbers are great or the numbers aren't so great. And then they figure out whether they're going to call that guy up or not. But they're looking way more in depth than the numbers. Mm-hmm. At the big league level, it's all about numbers. It's all about production. Quality of at-bats is a big thing. If they're going up there with the mindset of, okay, I'm going to try to work this guy deep into account, try to get something to hit later on, hope that he makes a mistake, that's not always going to happen. A lot of times the best pitch that you're going to see is the first pitch. I think that honestly this is a group that would do well to maybe be a little more aggressive. They run behind in counts way too often, 0-2, 1-2, and pitchers are just so good. They have such good stuff, and an elevated fastball coming in 97-plus, and so many starters and relievers can ramp up to that right now. That's just a tough pitch to hit, and you're seeing that all the time, and they're late on those fastballs. They're not able to get on top of those. So I think that they could do well to be a little more aggressive at the plate, and you know, they can still go in there with that control the zone and dominate the zone mentality. But if a pitch is over the middle of the plate or is just inner third or something, it's something you can handle. That's dominating the zone if you're in there first pitch and attacking that.
So, you know, one of the big questions is when you see something like this happen, you know, the easy thing to point to is, okay, well, what about the hitting coach? you know, what about Tim Laker, who is the hitting coach, and does there need to be a change there? Do you think that that is an adequate thing to point to, or do you think that that is overblown, overhyped, and that there's better things to be, you know, looking at?
The thing with an MLB hitting coach is they're not the end-all be-all for how these guys are hitting, right? And baseball is something where there's so much off-season work that goes into it, where players are doing stuff either themselves or with other coaches or scouts or something that are in the organization. They work out with fellow teammates and things like that. And this is a team that has, I think they have Tim Laker as the hitting coach. They have one or two other assistant hitting coaches. So there's not really just one guy that you can look to and say, okay, this is the problem. Tim Laker's been there for a while. He's obviously a guy that they trust. I think he's in his third or fourth season as the hitting coach. He took over after Edgar Martinez stepped down. And while we all love to have Edgar in the lineup, this was clearly somebody that they were comfortable enough with to where he was the successor. So looking at hitting coaches, I think that's just way too simplistic of a thing. I think Mitch Haniger last night after the game kind of summed it up, where those two guys are doing a good job getting them ready. Obviously, we don't know that, but that's coming from a leader and a respected player who's been their best hitter. It's up to them. They need to look in the mirror and they need to get it done at the end of the day. I think that blaming a hitting coach for it is just a little too simplified.
So when you try to make it a little more nuanced, is it a lack of confidence? Is it lack of experience? Is it lack of care for where the season is? I mean, what kind of factors in your mind? I mean, I know that you've played, you have friends that have played, and you've been covering the sport since I don't even know how long. I mean, I'm sure you're a lifelong baseball fan. What kind of stuff goes into when an entire team is just kind of collapsing?
That's what's hard. It's not super common that you see an entire 1 through 9 on a pretty regular basis going through and doing something like that. At this point of a season, you shouldn't look at a starting lineup and have 5 or 6 guys hitting in the 100s.
Right.
That's really tough. So it's hard because there's no one answer. And if there was one answer for it, I think that Scott Servais and that staff are smart enough to where they would have figured it out. I think that it was good to see in the last few weeks that he's kind of tinkered with lineups here and there. I think that with the call-up of Jared Kelenic and having him hit leadoff just because of who he is as a personality and the kind of skill set that he has, and he's such a fiery guy, I think that they are still hoping that he can kind of get going, and that sort of trickles down with that energy and whatnot and just that point of emphasis, because we see that this is a team that can put together at bats late in games. Early in the season, they're playing 4.5 hour long games when they're drawing walks and getting late hits and stuff after doing nothing for the first 5 innings. But it's kind of like with the Seahawks, where we talk about, why isn't this urgency that's in the second half, why isn't that in the first half? We're seeing that a lot with the Mariners too, where 7th inning, 8th inning, 9th inning, all of a sudden it's starting to click. It's just too late. I think there just needs to be a little more sense of urgency. Yeah, you can be worried about a starting pitcher having a low pitch count going late into games if you're aggressive early, but the flip side is he might be giving you a first pitch meatball over the plate that you can do some damage with, and that's more valuable than waiting it out and trying to get a 5-pitch ground out or something like that.
There are a couple guys not with the lineup right now that I'm curious if they'll improve it. I mean, one of them, Ty France. Have you heard about maybe how far away he is, and do you have any faith that when he gets back, he can look a little more like early season Ty France?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure what his timeline is. It seems like he'll probably be pretty close, but they were waiting on him to put him on the IL. He went on the IL the same day as Evan White, but they got announced a few hours apart. I think they were really kind of holding out hope that France would be a day-to-day thing, which seems to give me more hope that he'll be back sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. Risk things, obviously, for a hitter. I mean, that's what you need, right? So, but I'm hoping that he can get out there and he'll probably hit 5 or something like that, hit in the middle of the lineup, just at least lengthen it for the time being, just because this is a lineup that is having a lot of issues, especially in the back half. But if they can get what Ty France was for the first 3 weeks of the season or just something close to it, that just does wonders for that 1 through 9.
You know, Brandon, obviously the no-hitter overshadows Justin Dunn and his accomplishment. You know, he had 9 strikeouts, most ever as a Mariner thus far in this outing last night. What have you seen from him? What have you seen of his development? And what do you want to see more of moving forward with him?
Yeah, the stuff has ticked up big time this year. Watching him last year, it was kind of surprising. In his first few starts, he's out there last year sitting like 90 to 92 with the fastball. The breaking stuff just wasn't that sharp. And I'd seen a few of his starts when he was with Arkansas back in 2019 on MILB TV. and then just reading scouting reports and what people are writing about him and stuff. And they're saying this is a guy who's low to mid 90s with two hard and distinct breaking. We just didn't see that last year. And so that was kind of surprising to see. But this year he's ticked up the velocity. Both the breaking balls were really good for him, especially yesterday. So that's been nice to see. It all comes down to control with Justin Dunn. He's somebody who still walks too many people. He puts himself into too many instances where he has runners on base and it's all by his own doing. The MLB hitters are going to get their hits. That's the thing. But with a guy like Dunn, where those hitters are going up there knowing that there's a chance that he's just going to put them on, anything that's borderline, they're probably just going to take it at this point. That hurts his breaking balls because that's something that he could start over the plate and break it away. But if it's just kind of close or they know it's borderline, they might be taking it. So I hope that he can kind of ramp up that control. He only walked two people yesterday, and I know I say only, and that's maybe not the best thing still, but I hope that he's continuing to make strides with that because the stuff has really, really ticked up.
Brandon, one of the conversations we've had with Shannon Dreyer before is, when do you stop focusing on development as your number one priority and on winning as the number one priority? Both of those things still overlap, right? Every team focused on development still wants to win. Every team that's wanting to win and focusing on winning still cares about development. But when we've talked about when to make that transition, I assumed it might kick in just a little bit when Kelnick and Gilbert got here, which I honestly expected to be a little further apart. But I'm wondering now if it's going to take just a little bit more of this wave coming up. When you look at your best guesstimate at a timeline, do you feel like they're at a place now when you expect that transition to happen? Or is this something you're still looking at when the next couple prospects get up?
I think it's still down the line, and that's where I think that missing out on minor league baseball and that development last year really hurts them, because going into 2020 with the mindset of it's going to be a full 162 game season, a lot of these guys that are making their debuts this year, they might have debuted towards the end of last year. I think that a lot of people were kind of hoping that that upswing would kind of start like August of or September of last year. It's like it's probably July, August, September of this year as Kelnick and Gilbert find their footing, as Cal Raleigh gets called up because they just have gotten no production on either side of the ball from their catchers with Luis Torrens and Tom Murphy. So, and then there's other guys that are waiting in the wings. Maybe we see George Kirby as a late call-up too. He's been throwing the ball really, really well down in the minors. So I think that, unfortunately for Mariner fans, patience is still kind of the key. I know that that's upsetting given that we kind of had gone into 2021 initially hoping that this would be when they start to turn the corner. And you know, I could be wrong. It could happen sooner than that. Their record isn't that bad. It's just that when you're going out there and kind of floundering for seven innings or so, seemingly three, four, five times a week, it just puts that under the microscope a little bit. But I think this is a team that towards the second half of the year, we'll see some of these young guys really start to click and put this thing in the right direction.
He is Brandon Gustafson. He's a reporter and writer for 710sports.com. Go read his stuff on 710sports.com. He has new articles up there regularly. And go follow him, you guys, at the B. Gustafson. Brandon, was there another B. Gustafson you had to differentiate yourself from that you've been fighting for some handles over?
No, it was that when I typed my full name, I was like two characters too long.
Got
so
it.
I was like, okay, now what's next?
In this way, people know it's you. It's not just any Brandon Gustafson. It's the B. Gustafson, the actual local celebrity that you guys know and love. Brandon, you are the best. Thanks so much for joining us and helping us make sense of what's happening with the Mariners. We can't wait to keep reading your coverage.
Thanks, Brandon.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Don't forget, it's not too late to enter to win a 710 ESPN Seattle smart speaker at 710sports.com/win. We're still giving them away every day in the month of May. There are 31 days in May. 31 days in May.
Are you sure about that?
Yes. Then all you'll have to do is say, play 710 ESPN Seattle to your brand new smart speaker, and you can listen to our shows all day long. With that, it's 12:15. That means it's time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down to you, Jake. Will there be some growing pains between Russell Wilson and Shane Waldron to start the 2021 season?
Yeah, this was a question that was asked to me by Paul Gallant. I joined him for his show at 10:30. He asked me this question, and I think this is an important one to address because, yeah, I do think there'll be some growing pains, but I don't think it'll come in the form of bad performances. anytime you have a new offensive coordinator and a franchise quarterback, there needs to be a learning process between the two of them. The greatest example of that and the most recent example of that is Tom Brady with the Buccaneers, right? Tom Brady not only having to learn the offense virtually, but during the season, Bruce Arians, Byron Leftwich, they were adamant that Tom Brady, no, he is going to come in and conform to my system, the way that we do things. And there was a bit of a struggle there because it didn't necessarily highlight the strengths of Tom Brady. And halfway through the season, they had a little bit of a meeting and a little bit of a kumbaya deal going on. And Tom Brady basically saying, Stacey, to Bruce Arians, look, I'm the GOAT. Let me do what I do best. Let's work together and let's change some things offensively so that I can feel comfortable and that we can start firing on all cylinders. And they go on and win a Super Bowl. With Shane Waldron and Russell Wilson, Shane Waldron's coming in with an offensive scheme and a system that he knows works and that he is very confident in. So he's not going to be changing his entire scheme or system, but it's learning what your quarterback really is comfortable with. Comfortable with what he responds to best, how he operates best, and I think that those are things that those two are going to work out between the two of them. That's already begun in the offseason. It's gone about as good as you could ever want it to go between Russell Wilson, Shane Waldron, the offensive group, and how Russ is picking up the offense and all that, and the communication that is there. It's very exciting, but I do think that there will be some times where you're going to have to look at it and really come together and say, all right, what's best for our group, not just what is the playbook.
Second down. All right, Stacey.
DJ.
I thought you were going to throw in a yeah, like at the end. An improved year for the Seahawks wide receivers might mean fewer yards for both DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. Why?
This is why I phrased this question this way, because the other day I was writing one of Jake's fantastic four down territory questions in which he answered which Seahawks position group has the best chance to improve the most in 2021. And one of the groups Jake included was tight ends. I looked at potentially a runner-up as wide receiver, and as I was writing it, I was like, well, wait a minute. I already know the question someone's going to have in their mind. How can you improve when you had two Seahawks wide receivers surpass 1,000 yards in the same season for the first time since 1995, quite literally the year DJ was born? How can you possibly improve from that? The answer is that there's just going to be more to go around, and that is a good thing. So, for context, just three teams had two or more receivers finish top 20 in targets last season. Kansas City, obviously, with Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill. The Rams with Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp. And Seattle with Metcalf and Lockett. If you take that to the top 15 in targets, you've got two teams. Kansas City and Seattle. Awesome. Here's the difference. Kansas City was top five in passes, right? In pass play percentage. Meaning there was more to go around, and obviously both these guys got a lot of it. Seattle was outside of the top 10. They still passed more than they ever had in years past, around 59%. But in that way, there were fewer passes than Kansas City to go around, and yet still the vast majority of them went to Metcalf and Lockett. The production from those two, while really stellar, also overshadowed a serious lack of depth. So with David Moore gone, the next closest guy is Freddie Swain. You needed Dwayne Eskridge. I think he's going to be a great addition. Therefore, look at wide receiver, not only an area to improve, but an area where if DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett don't get what they did last year, you may actually have been better.
Third down. All right, Jake. Joe Burrow reportedly will be full go to start the 2021 season. What are your expectations for the first round, for the number one overall pick, from 2020?
Yeah, I think when you look at Joe Burrow and his season a year ago, I mean, I thought he did an outstanding job given the situation that he was in with the Cincinnati Bengals. And yeah, there were some learning and growing moments, but before he got hurt, I mean, you're talking about 65% completion percentage, 13 touchdowns, 5 interceptions, over 2,600 yards. I mean, that's a very good campaign given the time frame in which he got hurt, which was, I think he was only a few games into the season, hadn't even gotten into the second half of the season at that point. So I think when you're Joe Burrow and you're going through this process, although you're recovering from a pretty severe injury with the ACL tear, you've added more weapons. They have made an effort to try and make their offensive line better. It's still not in a great position, but I do think that Joe Burrow is going to continue to keep developing, continue to keep going in the right direction. He showed very, very well for himself his rookie season. So I'm expecting the number one overall pick to build on a hopefully a healthy season, but a very, very good progress with him. And I think Joe Burrow is a good quarterback in this league. It's just a matter of how the Cincinnati Bengals can surround him with protection and talent that is going to allow him to make the Cincinnati Bengals more than just a bottom feeder of their division.
Fourth down.
Shots fired.
just speaking the truth.
The defensive back room for the Seahawks, outside of DJ Reed, I think we can all agree, is a little bit wide open. So does fourth-round pick Trey Brown out of Oklahoma have a chance to legitimately compete for a starting cornerback spot this season, Jake?
Well, I loved hearing this from Pete Carroll, and I'll get into what I loved about it after we hear from Coach.
He looks like he's going to be a real competitive player, and he made a couple plays out here today that did catch my eye. He's very, very bursty, and looks like he's going to take his shots and be an aggressive corner, and that's what he showed in college, and he showed it out here in the couple spots I saw today.
So I love the fact that he is aggressive. I love the fact that they saw that he was twitchy and explosive, but the thing that it really is going to stand out in terms of his ability to legitimately compete for a starting cornerback spot is his ability to read, react, and trust his instincts and go make plays. Get your hand on the football. And that is something that has been desperately lacking here for the past 3 to 4 years here in Seattle on defense from the cornerback spot. Not enough pass breakups. Not enough driving on the ball and being able to get your hand on the ball and create turnovers. And if Trey Brown has that level of instincts and is willing to trust his instincts in this cover three man-to-man scheme that they love to play, then I think Trey Brown definitely has a shot. I mean, I think he's got an uphill battle, and he's going to have to really fight for a job when it comes to the veteran guys that they currently have put together on the cornerback roster. But Trey Brown has got every chance to make to earn himself a starting spot, and I hope that the coaching staff really gives him that opportunity.
Good news and bad news for two West Coast teams. That's coming your way next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy,
brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Jake and Stacy this hour, by the way, brought to you by the Pro Club. Some bad news for the Angels. Outfielder Mike Trout sidelined 6 to 8 weeks with a calf strain. Angels were already reeling as of late. They've still got Ohtani, hit his 14th home run the other day off of Zach Plesic. That 14 home runs leads MLB, which is phenomenal. Unfortunately, they're, fourth in the AL West now and are certainly going to take a hit because of this. This also means, I believe, and DJ, you'll have to correct me on this one, that Trout will also be gone the next time the Mariners face the Angels, which I think will be in the month of May, perhaps?
Yeah. Wait. Oh, no, I'm looking. Right at the beginning of June.
First weekend of June.
They have a 4-game series down in L.A., and they will not see Mike Trout, but they'll see a Shohei Ohtani. So yeah. That's fun.
How about DJ with the
I like the confidence. You should. Yep, they'll face the Angels all right.
Man, The Angels are in a world of hurt. They were already struggling a little bit, but not having Mike Trout to be able to supplement some of that. Oof, that's brutal. But a long story short, the real story of the year and really of the Angels is Shohei Ohtani. I mean, as long as they got that guy, you're going to still have people showing up to the park because that guy is unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
You're going to have people showing up to the park, but are you going to be making any kind of real impact in the AL West? It is so weird. I'm telling you, every time I write down the standings and my little scorecard and I look at it, it's always just Texas and LA bouncing back and forth. And you're just like, I don't know how you can have two amazing players, two of the best players, including the best player in baseball, and you're just hovering here.
I mean, is Shohei Ohtani going to is he going to be close to winning? I mean, he's going to be the MVP of the league if he keeps this up. I mean,
with a team that may not even
with
like
a team
make the
that
postseason?
Just exactly that's just crazy. Absolute garbage. But he's just that good. I mean, seriously. I mean, yeah, if he is able to keep that up, I mean, how do you not?
Oh, yikes. Going to the NFL. Now, I said two West Coast teams, one gets bad news, one gets good news. The West Coast team that gets bad news, obviously the Angels with Mike Trout missing 6 to 8 weeks. Good news for the Seahawks, though. They're going to be on the road against Washington, and FedEx Field will undergo its first major field reconstruction since opening in 1997. DJ, remind me how old you were.
In what year? Sorry?
97.
In 97. I was two.
Gross.
I was two.
Gross. Since DJ was 2 years old, this field has not been officially renovated, and now it will, which is good news for the Seahawks and every other team that's going to play them this year.
Yeah, this is not only great news for Washington, this is great news for the NFL everywhere, right? I mean, we've experienced this ourselves when it comes to players getting injured on that field. You know, it is one of the worst fields in the NFL and known across the NFL for that. And, you know, when it comes to a league where they talk about player safety and having conditions like that, Stacey, it really is unacceptable. And so when you get to a point where now you're able to renovate this field, I mean, one, that's a positive, but I'm surprised it took this long to get that process. Maybe Dan Snyder was too worried about, you know, having to, you know, settle things in court with a number of different lawsuits and all the other different things that he's worried about. But, you know, finally they've gotten around to the field.
I've spent all of yesterday morning Googling mutual combat laws in Washington State and fistcuffs legal in Washington State. And I'll tell you why. Kwame Brown is getting into a fight with Stephen A. Smith and challenged him to fistcuffs to a fight in Washington State. And he explains why here.
Stephen A., you bald forehead, you were thinking you tough, saying all kind of like, oh, then you come see me. Well, let's go to Seattle and you sign a waiver. Well, Seattle, you ain't got to sign no waiver. Meet me in Seattle where you can have mutual combat and talk like that. I'll slap a toupee. It'll look like you got a toupee on the front of your head or how hard I'll slap the back of your head. The hell you talking about?
So, apparently this fight going down in Seattle. Now, like any normal person, I tried to find the answer to a complicated law on Reddit where someone said apparently there's no mutual combat law. It's just written in such a way that excluding domestic relationships, it's a little trickier to prosecute someone. So I don't quite understand it. I don't know if they quite understand it. But
the fact that here's the thing, though. The fact that Kwame Brown knows that, he knows where in the country that
That's
you can
amazing.
Have hand-to-hand combat without getting prosecuted. If I'm Stephen A., one, I would, you know, shut my mouth and when it comes to Kwame Brown, and I'd walk away from that situation.
Like, but if someone's that specific with it?
Certainly in that situation, not a chance. If anybody was saying, hey, let's go to Seattle, let's go to, you know, Florida or wherever city where I can fight you hand-to-hand combat and not get in trouble, yeah, I'm staying away from that person because they know that way, way, way too well.
All right, now we all saw the video, and if you didn't, don't look it up, of Kevin Pillar suffering multiple nasal fractures after being hit in the face on Monday. He did a press conference and said that he's more worried about the well-being of Braves pitcher Jacob Webb.
I know this guy didn't want to hit me. I know he didn't want to hit me in the face. The bases were loaded, and it was a 1-0 game, and accidents do happen. So, you know, in that regard, there's... I know he feels bad. I know me and him have talked last night, today. I'm almost more worried about him than I am myself because I know I saw his reaction and I know how tough that can be on someone who feels, you know, responsible for someone getting injured, how he feels. And I just tried to relay that message to him that, you know, I know that it was unintentional and he needs to continue to be confident and believe in himself and his stuff.
This is... First of all,
wow.
Phenomenal sportsmanship and really big of him. And secondly, I think maybe a guy like Jacob Webb needs to hear it because if you didn't see it, Jake, I'm not sure if you did. I only saw it on Twitter, the video of it, but it was enough to show Webb's reaction. He looked physically ill. Like he looked nauseous.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not? I mean, that's just devastating, right? I mean, you could literally kill somebody with how hard those guys throw. Taking that to the face, I mean, you just don't know the impact of what that has in that moment, right? And so, absolutely scary. And you see his face, and you see him talk, Kevin Pillar, that is, and you're just like, my goodness, that is absolutely incredible. And I think the fact that Pillar is thinking of Webb and in that moment is just incredible. Very incredibly big of him, but I think also when you talk about it, it's just having empathy and realizing that, look, he didn't mean to do this, and I know that he feels awful about it, and an accident's an accident, but absolutely incredible.
All right. We still have a very special guest to bring you guys. He's going to join us for the entire third hour of the show. Lots of Seahawks talk going to be happening. We're also going to be playing Hype Train with some Seahawks and Mariners topics. Before we get to any of that, though, once again, we are seeing why the unwritten rules in baseball are stupid. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
We have a Seahawks reporter on with us regularly, and every time we have him on, people are so excited. You can hear him on 710 ESPN Seattle. I'm not going to tell you who it is yet, but he's going to join us in 15 minutes for the entire third hour of the show. It's going to be really fun. We're going to have his notes from Seahawks camp so far. We're going to go over the biggest stories in the NFL. We're going to play Hype Train, which he doesn't know how it works yet, but he's going to find out. It's a great game. And then we're obviously going to have What I Need to Know, just like we do every single day. Now, before we get to any of that, we have one more baseball story to talk about, Jake, and this one had everyone talking. It's obviously about Tony La Russa saying, kind of preaching about the old school unwritten rules of baseball, and once again, that coming to a head with, in particular, a younger generation of fans. So let's backtrack. It starts with Yermin Mercedes hitting a home run off a position player in a 3-0 count. What was it? Top of the ninth, bottom of the ninth? Either way, they'd checked out. Twins had checked out of the game. They're done. Send in a position player. 3-0 count. This happens.
Astudillo. Oh, he loaded up. Mercedes tattoos it to center. It is gone.
There you go.
A 3-0 swing. And it's 16-4.
Well, I'm thinking that probably does it.
Well, Mercedes owes half his salary in Kangaroo Court for swinging 3-0 on Astudillo, but he'll get over it.
Swinging 3-0 and it's 15-4. But then again, I mean, you don't really need to take a walk, I don't think.
Narrator, he did not get over it because, in fact, there was some retribution later. Before we got to that, though, Tony La Russa, Yermin's own skipper, had this to say.
There's a sportsmanship, respect for the game, respect for your opponent that's real. It has to be the philosophy, and we follow it. I've been taught it. And, the fact that he's a rookie who's excited helps explain why he just was clueless. But now he's got a clue.
Now, he also said there's going to be some consequences.
But he missed a 3-0 hit sign with that kind of lead. That's just, it's not over. That's just sportsmanship, respect for the game, respect for your opponent. He made a mistake. So, there'll be a consequence that he has to endure here within our family. But it won't happen again because, Joe will be on the lookout and I will be too. And we'll go running in front of the pitcher. We have to.
Now, Jake, take La Russa's comments and the way he handled out of it, right? Take the behavior aspect of what he did out of it. Is the point right? Should he have swung?
I mean, if he had the sign to not swing, then okay. If he didn't, then I don't have a problem with it. I really don't. I mean, I think when we talk about the fun factor of baseball, I think if you're going to roll out, again, I'm sorry, I didn't realize this was the Little Leagues. I didn't realize that at some point in time you're going out there and, the other team can wave the white flag and say, hey, we're done. We're not going to continue to play. That's your decision if you're the Twins to roll out an infielder and have him go out there and throw, an absolute, just softball right down the middle and, high part of the strike zone and have, Mercedes just take it, right? And what do you want him to do? You want him to strike out? You want him to wait till he throws a fourth ball? I mean, what would you rather see him do in that situation? So, to me, I think this is overblown by Tony La Russa. I think these are, you know, one of the talk about the unwritten rules of baseball. To me, you can be upset at Mercedes swinging at that pitch and hitting a home run. Fine. If that's what you want to be mad at. But I hate that Tony La Russa,
like, shamed him, next, kind of.
Well, not just shamed him, but the very next day, the Twins go out and throw at Mercedes, and he says, I'm good with that. I don't have a problem with the way the Twins handled it. I'm sorry, but that to me is not okay. Like, I don't care who you are as a manager. That's your guy. You're supposed to protect your guy.
I threw a sinker, and, you know, it looked good. I wasn't that suspicious. I'm suspicious somebody throws it to somebody's head. And they're not suspicious. So I don't have a problem with how the Twins handled that.
Come on, Tony. It's not suspicious to me. They didn't throw at his head. He threw it all the way behind him. Like, it was clear what was happening. That was retribution. That was, hey, watch it. We saw what you did, and this is another one of those unwritten rules, right? It's the same thing of, like, you hit our first baseman, we might hit yours kind of thing. It was that thing. You knew what it was. I don't love the way that La Russa is handling it. I don't. I think that, you know, say what you will about a guy like Scott Service. Earlier we were talking about maybe wanting to see a more aggressive tone and sense of urgency. I also don't think he's a guy to throw his own guys under the bus like this. I hate the way he handled this. How am I supposed to feel if I'm one of your players?
Yeah, I go back to the Twins. The Twins, you decided to do this, right? You rolled that guy out there instead of putting one of your pitchers in the game. That's your decision. That's your mistake. And everybody else shouldn't just, you know, play along with it just because. And so, again, if Mercedes had disobeyed a rule, a sign from La Russa and the coaching staff, then that is entirely different to me. Then, yes, Mercedes would be absolutely in the wrong. But with what he did in that moment and there was no sign given, I don't think that, you know, he did – you know, anything wrong in the moment. And I don't think that it was worth retaliation the next day. I really don't think it was that serious. And if you're Tony La Russa and you're saying that, hey, that I've got a problem with that, then maybe you need to make that more clear before your guy gets into that situation. But I agree with you. I don't like the way he handled it. And I think that the unwritten rules of baseball sometimes are so arbitrary that it doesn't even make sense anymore. Well, it used to be a thing. I mean, it used to be a very legitimate thing that everybody knew basically what the unwritten rules of baseball were back in the day. Now, I think it's so not everybody runs their club that way. And the unwritten rules are just, it doesn't make much sense anymore like it did back then.
Well, and if your unwritten rules punish bad sportsmanship, fine. Like, no, there's no room for bad sportsmanship. And you could argue that this is bad sportsmanship. I think there is a fair argument you could make, hypothetically, where you could kind of state your case as to why this is somehow bad sportsmanship. I'm not going to agree with you, but I don't think it's way outside the line of rationality to try to make that case. What you end up doing, though, is having unwritten rules that punish having fun, that punish attitude, that punish cockiness, that punish just like athleticism and not giving up when the opponent has. So what if you gave up and sent in your position player? You could send in a young pitcher to get some reps. You could send in one of your bullpen guys if you want. Instead, you gave up. Why is it the fault or the responsibility of this young, exciting player that's supposed to help bring you new young fans to baseball to have a boring at-bat? I don't know. I understand the rule. I think we need less unwritten rules that try to make baseball less fun and less exciting, and more that just, I don't know, actually do away with them. We don't need more. Take it back, DJ. All right. This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Joe Fan is here. He's back there. Hi, Joe. Hey, buddy. Okay, there he is. He's waving. He is in the control room. He's going to be joining us for the final hour of Jake and Stacey. We're going to be starting with his notes from Seahawks camp. And plus, we've got some questions about veterans potentially missing OTAs. That's coming your way next.